3. Yearling Row Ranch, Santa Monica Mountains, California, December 22, 1951, morning. 40-year-old Ronald Reagan gallops Tar Baby over the rolling countryside of his new 270-acre Malibu ranch. He rides English style, wearing skin-tight jodhpurs and knee-high Daner riding boots. Christmas is just days away. The air is crisp on this winter morning, the skies clear and blue. Reagan's two children, home on break from Chadwick boarding school, are spending the weekend in the small shingled ranch house back near the barn. But this weekend is not just a time for a father and his kids. Reagan's latest girlfriend, a 30-year-old actress named Nancy Davis, has joined them. Though she works very hard to endear herself to his son and daughter, and Maureen and Michael like her very much, Reagan is unsure about this blossoming relationship. He is not ready to be monogamous and is still seeing other women. Yet Davis is determined to win his heart, by any means necessary. Recently, Davis confessed to Reagan that she might be pregnant. Yet rather than encouraging Reagan to propose marriage, the announcement has the opposite effect. He flees to the home of Christine Larson, the starlet who spurned his offer of marriage earlier this year. Reagan complains to her that he feels trapped by Davis and wonders aloud if she is trying to trick him into marrying her. But on this day, Reagan does not feel confined. He rides tall and easy in the saddle, feeling the black mare moving beneath him. His connection with Baby is so strong that Reagan now insists upon riding her during on-screen horseback shots. This time last year, they were in Tucson, Arizona, filming the western The Last Outpost, which has become a minor success at the box office. The film's horse wranglers warned Reagan that the desert location's heat and dust might prove fatal to the mare. But the actor knows his horse well. Tar Baby survived the grueling shoot without a single problem. Now, riding on a dirt path lined with sycamores and scrub oak, past Malibu Lake, where he plans to swim in the summer, and the hayfield that parallels distant Mulholland Drive, Reagan finds himself at a curious career crossroads. Bedtime for Bonzo was such a box office success that a sequel is in the works. Reagan received mixed notices for his comedic performance, with most reviewers preferring to focus their praise on Peggy the Chimp. The New York Times called Bonzo a minor bit of fun yielding a respectable amount of laughs, but nothing actually over which to wax ecstatic. Reagan was barely mentioned in the review. Despite Bonzo's success, he is not offered a role in the sequel. The sequel is titled Bonzo Goes to College. It stars Edmund Gwenn, best known for his role as Kris Kringle in the classic Miracle on 34th Street, for which he won an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. On top of that, Reagan's tenure as president of the Screen Actors Guild will soon come to an end. It is a time of upheaval and change in Hollywood, and Reagan has been in the thick of the pitched battle between the studios and an emerging communist presence in the show business community. His double life, as he calls his now intersecting twin passions of acting and politics, has consumed him. The ranch has been a tonic in these tough times, his Saturday getaway to clear his head from the strife. Reagan has been the head of SAG for 5 years, but no year has been more intense than 1951. In addition to acting in 3 films and attending the Monday night SAG board meetings, he has also traveled around the country speaking on behalf of an anti-communist group known as Crusade for Freedom. The purpose? To raise money for Radio Free Europe. And though Reagan is still very much a Hollywood actor, the words he scripts for himself are those of a seasoned international politician. The battleground of peace today is that strip of strategically located countries stretching from the Baltic to the Black Sea, Reagan says in a recorded speech that is replayed to small groups around America. They are not big countries geographically, but they contain several million freedom-loving people, our kind of people, who share our culture and have sent millions of their sons and daughters to become part of these United States. Some call these countries the satellite nations. More accurately, they're the captive nations of Europe. Reagan is unaware that Crusade for Freedom is secretly backed by the Central Intelligence Agency, although he would likely be delighted if he knew. Ronald Reagan actually considered joining the Communist Party back in 1938. Many in Hollywood were romanced by the communists, as Adolf Hitler and his fascist ideology were becoming a threat not just to Europe, but to the entire world. The communists, with their avowed mission of helping the poor and disenfranchised, seemed poised to thwart Hitler's ambitions. But there was more to Reagan's attraction than mere ideology. As a newcomer to Hollywood, just 1 year into his studio contract, he saw becoming a communist as a good way to expand his social circle. Reagan got carried away by stories of the Communist Party helping the dispossessed, the unemployed, and the homeless. Screenwriter Howard Fast will claim years later. Some of his friends, people he respected, were party members, so he turned to them. Said he wanted to be a communist. Said he was determined to join. But actor Eddie Albert, a co-star in Brother Rat, was just as determined to talk Reagan out of turning red. Albert's motives were deceptive. He leaned far to the left politically and secretly undertook the discussion at the behest of the American Communist Party leadership, who believed that talkative Reagan was a flake and did not want him joining their group. Albert was successful. Reagan's brief flirtation with communism came to an end. His interest in politics, however, did not cease. It is August 11, 1941, when Ronald Reagan attends his first meeting of the Screen Actors Guild at the union's headquarters on Hollywood Boulevard. He has been invited to serve as an alternate for actress Heather Angel. The guild is just 8 years old at the time, founded to improve working conditions for actors. Reagan's first meeting is more of a social excursion, as he has little knowledge of the guild's inner workings. Even when Jane Wyman is elected to the board a year later, Reagan remains distant from SAG, involved as he is with the war effort. But he resumes attending meetings in February 1946 as an alternate for horror movie actor Boris Karloff. In September of that year, he is elected third vice president. By the end of World War II, with Hitler and the German Third Reich defeated, it is clear that Joseph Stalin and the communists are just as ruthless and just as intent on global domination as the Führer was. The Soviet Union, headquarters of global communism, displaces millions of people across Eastern Europe in order to build an empire even bigger than Hitler's. It is also sending spies out around the world to infiltrate other nations and spread propaganda. Reagan soon sees this played out quite clearly in Hollywood. The Actors' Union is slowly dividing itself into those, like Reagan, who now consider communism a scourge, and those who believe that the political system embraced by the Soviet Union is intellectual and fashionable. The important thing is that you should not argue with them. Communism has become an intensely dogmatic and almost mystical religion, and whatever you say, they have ways of twisting it into shapes which put you in some lower category of mankind, wrote novelist and screenwriter F. Scott Fitzgerald, describing the ideological tension in Hollywood. The illusion that communism is a harmless ideology is shattered on September 27, 1946, when the Confederation of Studio Unions goes on strike. The head of the union is Herb Sorrell, a rough-and-tumble former boxer who is also a longtime member of the Communist Party. The strike is funded by the National Executive Council of the Communist Party. When it ends up, Sorrell predicted, there'll be only one man running labor in Hollywood, and that man will be me. This is not a peaceful protest, but a violent and militant attempt by the communists to begin taking control of every major union in Hollywood and, by proxy, the motion picture industry itself. In addition to the striking union members, Sorrell has enlisted hired thugs from the San Francisco area to provide menace. Cars are overturned in the streets. Police fire tear gas at the picket lines blocking the entrance to the Warner Brothers studio. great mobs of strikers attack those attempting to cross the picket lines. Actor Kirk Douglas describes a scene of men armed with knives, clubs, battery cables, brass knuckles, and chains. Despite the violence, studio head Jack Warner refuses to buckle. He continues making movies. Actors and employees do not cross picket lines to get work. Instead, they are smuggled into the studio through a Los Angeles River storm drain. For those preferring not to endure the smells and slime of the subterranean entrance, the other option is riding a bus driven straight through the picket lines at Warner's front gate. Scores of police officers are called in to line the route, but cannot prevent the strikers from pelting the vehicles with rocks and bricks. Everyone on board the bus is instructed to lie down on the floor to avoid being hit in the head by broken glass and projectiles. Ronald Reagan, as vice president of the Screen Actors Guild, considers the storm drain a coward's entrance and refuses to lie down on the floor of the bus. No matter that he has two young children and a pregnant wife at home, Reagan puts himself at risk in order to make a statement. He is not afraid. Each day, arriving for work on a new film called Night Unto Night, Reagan is the lone person on the studio bus sitting upright for all to see. When the strikers later escalate their campaign by forcing the Screen Actors Guild to support the strike, an anonymous caller to Reagan's home threatens that he will be attacked and his face burned with acid if he tries to block SAG's pro-strike involvement. Furious, Reagan refuses to back down. Instead, he buys a pistol and carries it in a shoulder holster wherever he goes. For the rest of his life, Ronald Reagan will be vehemently anti-communist. For him, it is very personal. He will never forget the threats. 4 weeks into the confrontation, on October 24, 1946, Reagan and strike organizer Herb Sorrell sit down at Hollywood's Knickerbocker Hotel. Sorrell is a powerfully built man, fond of using physical intimidation to achieve his goals. But Reagan is no less strong, and is uncowed by Sorrell. He angrily accuses the union boss of being responsible for the threats. "I have to have guards for my kids because I got telephone calls warning what would happen to me," he seethes, before adding, "You do not want peace in the motion picture industry." Actor Gene Kelly is also at the meeting as a member of SAG's board of directors. He quickly steps in with a joke to keep the peace. "If Mr. Reagan hits Mr. Sorrell, I want it understood that this is not the official feeling of this body." Kelly was a man of high ideals who left the Catholic Church when he felt it was not doing enough to halt world hunger, yet donated money to the Provisional Irish Republican Army in its war against Protestants and the British occupation of Northern Ireland. The famous dancer, best known for Singin' in the Rain, was once quoted as saying, "I believe in God, the American way of life, the freedom of the individual, and everything the Constitution of the United States stands for." To Kelly, this also meant tolerance for the communists, which made him the perfect middleman for discussions between Reagan and Sorrell. Kelly's words have their desired effect. The meeting calms until it ends at 1:30 the following morning, but nothing is resolved. By December, with the strike in its third month, Reagan is calling a special meeting of SAG's 350 most elite members. Among them is actor Edward G. Robinson, a man known for playing gangsters on screen. Robinson is also one of Hollywood's most ardent communists. In a speech that those in attendance will remember for years to come, Reagan assures the membership of his solid standing as a New Deal Democrat and argues that the Guild should maintain a united stand against the strike. Even Robinson marvels at Reagan's clear and sequential presentation. Still, the strike drags on. The duration of the strike angers Reagan. He is appalled by the communist union leader's zealous desire to take control of Hollywood. What began as a battle of ideologies has now become Reagan's personal mission. He vows to fight communism wherever it may be. With Ronald Reagan gaining political confidence, Gene Kelly nominates him for president of the Screen Actors Guild. Veteran actors James Cagney, Robert Montgomery, Harpo Marx, and John Garfield have just stepped down from SAG leadership. Reagan is not present at the time of his nomination, arriving halfway through the meeting to find out that he has won. He is stunned. The term of office is 1 year, beginning in 1947. Almost immediately, Reagan is tested by communist sympathizers attempting to undermine his leadership. At a mass meeting, Reagan will later write, I watched rather helplessly as they filibustered, waiting for our majority to leave so they could take control. A voice in the crowd cries out that the meeting should be adjourned. I seized on this as a means of ending the attempted takeover, but the other side demanded I identify the one who moved for adjournment. Reagan is in a bind. While many in the Screen Actors Guild are against the communists, it is also a career liability to speak out publicly against them. The momentum of the communist movement is too great, and the possibility of being personally and professionally ostracized from the Hollywood community is very real. Reagan scans the crowd, searching for at least one individual with the backbone to be his ally in this heated moment. He sees his man. Why, I believe John Wayne made the motion, Reagan tells the crowd. Wayne is one of Hollywood's best-known tough guys, a former college football player whose starring roles in westerns and war movies have made him one of the most bankable box office stars in the world. And unlike many Hollywood heroes who look tall on the screen but are actually diminutive in real life, the gruff Wayne stands at a rugged 6'4". I sure as hell did, Wayne roars from the crowd. The meeting is adjourned. Finally, after 13 long months, the strike ends. Yet even as the studios emerge victorious, Hollywood's growing embrace of communism continues unabated, drawing the attention of the feared FBI chief, J. Edgar Hoover. In the waning days of their marriage, Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman are approached by FBI agents Richard Auerbach and Fred Dupuy, who come to their home uninvited on April 10, 1947. The agents ask the couple to report secretly to the FBI about people suspected of communist activity. Wyman and Reagan quickly offer up six names. This will be the end of Wyman's involvement with the FBI, but Ronald Reagan begins meeting frequently with the Bureau to provide more names and information. He is given a code name, T-10. Two of the people he names, actresses Karen Morley and Ann Revere, will not work in Hollywood for the next 20 years. Ronald Reagan believes this banishment is just, for he knows the women to be communists and thinks the Communist Party is an agent of a foreign power. Reagan will be damned if he will allow the motion picture industry to undermine the moral fabric of the United States of America. Ronald Reagan will never waver from the belief that informing for the FBI was the right thing to do, nor will he suffer any repercussions for it. I talked to Ronnie since, Jack Dales, executive secretary of SAG at that time, will comment years from now, and he has no doubts about the propriety of what we did. On October 23, 1947, Reagan travels to Washington to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee, a congressional group trying to root out subversive individuals and practices. Not to be confused with Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist investigations, HUAC was originally founded in 1938 to root out Nazi sympathizers. It switched its focus to communism as the Soviet Union rose to power. 34-year-old Richard Nixon, a newly elected California congressman, was a member of HUAC on the day Reagan testified, but was not in attendance. I believe that, as Thomas Jefferson put it, if all the American people know all of the facts, they will never make a mistake, said Reagan, responding to questions from HUAC chief investigator Robert Stripling. Whether the Communist Party should be outlawed, that is a matter for the government to decide. As a citizen, I would hesitate to see any political party outlawed on the basis of its political ideology. However, if it is proven that an organization is an agent of a foreign power, or in any way not a legitimate political party, and I think the government is capable of proving that, then that is another matter. Reagan's appearance before the committee is his first visit to Capitol Hill. It makes a lasting impression on him. Nearly 4 years after testifying before Congress, Ronald Reagan guides Tarbaby back to the barn. He hopes soon to add thoroughbred horse breeder to the many job titles that currently keep him busy, and plans to expand the simple barn into something more elaborate for that purpose. Reagan leads the mare into her stall and removes her bridle and saddle. Whistling softly to himself, he brushes her torso and flanks. The repetitive movement allows Reagan a contemplative moment. It is clear that Ronald Reagan needs to make some hard decisions about his future. He gets little respect for his roles as an actor, but he is held in such high esteem for his political activism that when the Friars Club recently honored him, they refrained from derogatory jokes and put-downs. Instead, the 600 members in attendance spent the evening lauding him with sincere speeches about his stature and dignity, with the legendary singer Al Jolson even going so far as to say that he wished his son would grow up to be the kind of man Ronnie is. But with his Guild presidency coming to an end, it seems that Reagan's political days will also cease. All the respect in the world from his Hollywood peers won't pay the bills. He must find a way to revive his career. The mortgage on his ranch alone is $85,000. Politics doesn't offer that kind of money. As Reagan steps out of the barn, walking to where Nancy Davis and his children wait inside the small ranch house, he faces a midlife crisis. Reagan well knows the truth. He is a 40-year-old Hollywood has-been on the verge of losing everything. As he enjoys a brief time of quiet and solitude on this cool December morning, he is unsure of what 1952 has in store for him, hardly aware that it is the year in which he will remarry, father a new child, and vote Republican for the first time in his life. 4. Studio City, California, March 4, 1952, 5 p.m. "I do," says Ronald Reagan, looking into the large brown eyes of a pregnant Nancy Davis. He is dressed in a black wedding suit with narrow matching tie. Davis, who clutches a fragrant bouquet of orange blossoms and white tulips, does not wear a wedding gown. Instead, she has chosen to wear a gray woolen suit bought off the rack at the I. Magnin department store in Beverly Hills. A single strand of pearls is draped around her neck. The Reverend John Wells, a Disciples of Christ minister, stands before the small, bare table that represents the altar here at the Little Brown Church. He asks Davis if she, too, agrees to be wed, "till death do you part." "I do," she replies. Nancy Davis has campaigned hard for this moment since setting her sights on Ronald Reagan 3 years ago. She is undaunted by his flings with other women, accepting his indiscretions while enjoying a few brief affairs of her own. Davis knows that there are two keys to Reagan's heart, politics and horses. So she has spent hours whitewashing fences at the actor's Malibu ranch and attending the Monday night SAG board meetings to watch him lead the proceedings. "I loved to listen to him talk," Davis will write of their courtship, "and I let him know it." Standing in the chapel to Reagan's right is his best man, the hard-drinking actor William Holden. The 33-year-old Academy Award nominee for Sunset Boulevard has taken a break from filming the World War II drama Stalag 17 to be at the ceremony. His wife, Artis, is serving as Davis's matron of honor. The Holdens have been fighting today and are not on speaking terms. That is not an unusual situation in their 11-year marriage. The main issue between them is infidelity. Holden underwent a vasectomy after the birth of their second son and is fond of bedding his co-stars without fear of getting them pregnant, thus leaving his wife in a constant state of jealousy and torment. Even as Ronald Reagan and Nancy Davis recite their vows, awash in apparent marital bliss, The Holdens sit on opposite sides of the tiny church. Other than these four and the gray-haired Reverend Wells, who presides wearing a flowing black robe, there is no one else in attendance for the Reagan-Davis wedding, which makes the Holdens' feud glaringly obvious. The Reagan children, Maureen and Michael, are away at school. Even though a formal wedding announcement was made on February 21st and gossip writer Luella Parsons spread the word to 20 million people worldwide through her syndicated newspaper column, the ceremony is stunningly casual. There was no limousine to ferry the couple to the church. Instead, Reagan picked Nancy up at her apartment in the Cadillac convertible purchased for him by Jane Wyman. In addition, there is no formal reception. The group will adjourn to the Holdens' ranch-style home in nearby Toluca Lake for a quick bite of cake and a splash of champagne before Reagan and Davis drive 2 hours to Riverside's Mission Inn for their wedding night. Reagan's initial wedding proposal fell far short of romance. Davis had longed that Ronnie would take me out in a canoe as the sun was setting and would strum a ukulele as I lay back, trailing my fingers in the water, the way they used to do in the old movies I saw as a little girl. Instead, Reagan simply pronounced, "Let's get married," over dinner at a Hollywood nightclub shortly after Davis told him she was pregnant, to which she replied, after gazing into his eyes and placing her small hands atop his, "Let's." Nancy Davis was so eager to marry Ronald Reagan that she willingly accommodated his every wish. If that meant a small ceremony, lacking fanfare, or even a hint of the media flashbulbs that might provide a modicum of grandeur, then so be it. Nancy was released from her Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer studio contract just 2 weeks prior. "I don't want to do anything else except be married. I just want to be Ronnie's wife," she says later. To Reagan, this anonymous wedding is perfect. His life seems to become more complicated by the day, and he hardly needs a horde of press to remind him that his career is in peril. In addition to dealing with Davis's pregnancy, Reagan was released from his contract with Warner Brothers just 5 weeks ago. He claims that he wants a small ceremony because the memory of his lavish first wedding to Jane Wyman is still painful. But the truth is that to even contemplate facing reporters and flashbulbs made me break out in a cold sweat, as Reagan will one day write. The wedding is so discreet that Reagan has not even invited his mother, Nell. His father, Jack, died more than a decade ago, but Nell Reagan now lives nearby in Southern California. But even though Reagan has a close relationship with his mother, who is a member of the Disciples of Christ denomination, she is not in attendance. Nancy, on the other hand, has no living relations in Hollywood. Her godmother was Alla Nazimova, the late owner of the legendary Garden of Allah Hotel. Coincidentally, the same den of iniquity was the place where Reagan promised himself that he would stop sleeping around. Thanks to that moment and to his relationship with Nancy, he is now seen less and less in the nightclubs of Hollywood, preferring to spend weekends at the Malibu Ranch. "It's not that I hunger for somebody to love me," Reagan has confided to Nancy, finally putting the memory of his divorce in the rearview mirror, "as much as I miss having somebody to love." "I pronounce you man and wife," says Reverend Wells, adjusting his thin wire-frame glasses. Davis is so swept away by the moment that she will not remember saying, "I do," or even Ronald Reagan's kiss as their marriage is sealed. Instead, she will recall only the booming voice of Bill Holden as he comes to her side. "Can I kiss the bride?" he asks.
"Not yet," Davis protests. "It's too soon."
But as the svelte artist looks on, Holden wraps his arms around Nancy's waist and kisses her passionately on the lips. Ardis Ankerson has arranged for a photographer to be present at her house as a beaming Nancy Reagan slices wedding cake with her new husband. The three tiers of white frosting, with the small plastic statue of bride and groom perched on top, rests on the Holden's dining room table. Reagan blinks as the shutter clicks, while Nancy leans in toward the camera with eyes wide open.
It is a moment both iconic and timeless, recreated at countless weddings before and since. If not for artists possessing the forethought to hire a photographer, there would have been no pictures of this moment. The resulting images are unassuming. Yet one day they will be considered remarkable, for this evening begins a marriage that will change the world. It is midnight as the newly married Reagans arrive at the Mission Inn, an elaborate structure built to look like an old Spanish mission with great stucco walls, exposed beams, and a garden courtyard. A bouquet of red roses waits in their room, compliments of the house. In Ronald Reagan, Nancy sees a greatness that thus far has eluded him. She will dedicate her life to bringing it forth. Soon her supplication will vanish, and dominance will emerge. Reagan will reluctantly cease his womanizing, although continuing his affair with Christine Larson well past the day his baby daughter Patty is born, on October 21, 1952. Reagan is not at the hospital the night Patricia Ann Reagan is delivered by cesarean section. He is in the arms of Larson. However, that relationship comes to an end shortly thereafter when Reagan shows up at Larson's apartment and a French actor wearing just a small towel answers the door. Nancy will never acknowledge that she is aware of the relationship, but will later comment, "When I was back in my room and the nurses brought me our baby for the first time, my first thought was that it was sad that Ronnie couldn't be there." Reagan never provided an excuse for his absence. Nancy just accepted that he wasn't there. And while there will be the occasional discreet liaison in the future, Reagan's days as a playboy are in the past. In time, these affairs will come to haunt him. Not a man normally given to regrets, Reagan will rue his behavior as his love for Nancy grows deeper. "If you want to be a happy man," he will counsel a friend years from now, "just don't ever cheat on your wife." Nancy Reagan possesses an inner steel that her husband lacks. This quality will soon make her opinions indispensable. She will become his sounding board, tactician, and advisor, prodding and cajoling him to become the man only she believes he can be. And while Reagan will always be Ronnie to his wife, the power in their marriage will slowly shift until Nancy becomes the matriarch known to her husband as Mommy. Of such odd synergy are great marriages made. 5. Last Frontier Casino, Las Vegas, Nevada, February 27, 1954, 8:55 p.m. The man with a long 50 years to live is in exile. Ronald Reagan bounds on stage wearing an apron advertising Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. "Was willst du haben?" he booms in a thick European accent to Ben Cruz, leader of a slapstick group known as the Continentals. "Was du got on the dare?" Cruz says in a bemused voice, pointing at the hem of Reagan's long apron. Reagan replies, scratching his groin. "Underwear?" "Under dare," replies Cruz, pointing at the hem of Reagan's long apron. Then, as the audience bursts out in ribald laughter, Reagan and the Continentals break into song, a well-established vaudeville routine. Reagan's appearance in Las Vegas is such an oddity that after his first show, the Las Vegas Sun wrote incredulously that Ronald Reagan, of all people, opened last night at the Last Frontier. But tonight's audience is learning that Reagan can handle the vaudeville stage and is a master showman. His comedic timing in particular is impeccable. The 300 audience members packed into the Ramona Room roar in laughter at his beer vendor shtick. But Reagan is not finished. Quickly, he switches over to an Irish brogue for a series of scripted one-liners. A wave of deep belly laughs fills the room. Before the show opened, there were widespread fears that the Hollywood actor would bomb in front of a live audience. But Reagan is so spectacular, and the subsequent audiences each night love the show so much, that the Last Frontier wants to book him for another month, if not more. Reagan opens with some solid humor, and the enthusiastic response loosens him to the point he is grinning all over. The show business newspaper Variety wrote in a review, "He shines as a Dutch jargon bartender in a beer-selling bit." Despite the positive press, Reagan is in fact terrified. The Last Frontier is an apt name for the casino because it might just as well describe the slim territory of celebrity to which Ronald Reagan now clings. He can no longer afford a single miscue. He almost backed out of the Las Vegas gig, knowing all too well that if the show failed, his declining career would be all but over. Even though the show is a hit, Reagan hopes that this is not his future. Nothing about the remote desert town suits him. He is not a gambler. He reads books in his off time or lounges by the pool with Nancy. Sometimes they take day trips to nearby Lake Mead to indulge his passion for the outdoors. But Reagan longs to be back in California riding Tar Baby and making movies. However, that choice is not his to make. He now has a wife and child to support, as well as the two children from his previous marriage. Reagan is paying the mortgage on his Malibu ranch and on the new home he and Nancy recently purchased near the Pacific Palisades. He is thousands of dollars in debt and owes a small fortune in back taxes, yet still he insists on living the life of a major movie star, dining at expensive restaurants such as Chasen's and doing little to curb his personal spending habits. Reagan tells his friends he will not accept any part that is not up to his personal standards, when the truth is that quality scripts are no longer being sent his way. Instead, he is being asked to narrate public service documentaries for the grand fee of just $240. So Vegas it is. Ronald Reagan performs at 8:30 and 11:30 each night, with an extra 1:30 a.m. show on Saturdays. After the beer garden sketch, Reagan and the Continentals rush off stage for a costume change. Meanwhile, tall and handsome Royce and Ramon Blackburn step on stage to perform their song and dance act as the Blackburn Twins. The Honey Brothers trio follows with a slapstick acrobatic comedy routine that often finds them close to flying off the stage. Finally, Reagan closes out the performance standing alone, lit by a single spotlight, reciting a monologue about an actor's life. It's a grind, but the money is extremely good. Reagan is not the only fading celebrity reduced to playing Las Vegas. At the Sands, a casino just down the strip from the Last Frontier, former movie star Tallulah Bankhead appears on stage almost naked, also reciting dramatic monologues. Throughout the show, Nancy Reagan sits alone at a small table nursing an ice water. Nancy, who has never smoked cigarettes, is enveloped by thick clouds of tobacco smoke, making it almost impossible for Reagan to see her from the stage. Yet he knows she is there. Despite the oppressive atmosphere, Nancy attends every show, perched in the same spot every night, surrounded by strangers. Ronald Reagan's career slide has been hard on the ambitious Nancy. As she watches her husband do underwear jokes, she is determined to live a life of fame and fortune. Nancy Reagan was raised in privilege, but she now finds herself in debt. This is intolerable to her. Nancy's entry into Hollywood was facilitated by her mother's friendships with A-list actors Spencer Tracy and Walter Huston, and there was every expectation that her marriage to Reagan would continue to expand those high-level connections. But now, nursing her ice water, she well understands that she and Ronnie are no longer welcome at the A-list parties. Despite the raucous crowd packing the cavernous Ramona room on this Saturday night, there is abundant evidence that Reagan is finished in Hollywood. Nancy is 300 miles away from Los Angeles, sitting alone in a gambling establishment designed to look like an Old West outpost. Outside, a cold winter wind blows across the wide-open desert. She and her husband are so far off the Hollywood grid that they might as well be in Siberia. Yet Nancy Reagan clings to the hope that Las Vegas will soon lead to something better. America is fascinated by a new medium known as television, which beams entertainment directly inside the homes of people everywhere. As a result of its popularity, more than 5,000 movie theaters have closed due to declining ticket sales. Ronald Reagan has done a dozen guest appearances on various television shows, but he is reluctant to pursue TV full-time. The people who owned movie theaters thought that nobody would buy a ticket to see someone they could see at home in their living room for nothing, he will one day write. Nancy is not as cautious. The Reagans need money. Television is the future. MCA, the talent agency representing Reagan, is pushing him in that direction, and so is his wife. A few months before heading to Las Vegas, Reagan reluctantly agreed to audition to host a show for the CBS television network titled General Electric Theater. It will air every Sunday night for a half hour at 9 p.m. The pay is $125,000 per year, more than enough to get the Reagans out of debt and keep the couple current on their mortgage payments. There is no assurance Reagan will get the job, as veteran actors Eddie Albert, Walter Pidgeon, and Kirk Douglas have also been interviewed for the position. But should Ronald Reagan be offered the GE job, Nancy will make sure he takes it. The time is now almost 10 o'clock on this Saturday night. In a moment, Nancy will duck backstage to be with her husband for a quick bite of dinner between shows. She is determined to return home as soon as possible and never come back. She cannot imagine a life of sitting alone each night for 3 hours of vaudeville, losing contact with Hollywood with each passing day, while minor film celebrities such as Lucille Ball are achieving vast fame and fortune on television. Nancy Reagan stirs her ice water, hearing the cue that signals the end of the performance. "You see things and say, why?" Reagan emotes from the stage, quoting the Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw. A single spotlight illuminates him, alone in his tuxedo, speaking to the audience as if each and every member was a personal friend. "But I dream things that never were, and say, why not?" The Ramona Room is silent, but only for an instant. Then the audience leaps to their feet in a standing ovation. The showman grins from ear to ear, basking in what has become a nightly occurrence. If Reagan has learned one thing in Las Vegas, it is that he truly loves a live audience, and they love him back. 1 week later, on March 5, 1954, Ronald Reagan turns down an offer to extend his run at the Last Frontier. Television calls. "I'm Ronald Reagan, speaking for General Electric," the actor says into the television microphone. The broadcast is live, taking place on December 12, 1954. "Tonight from Hollywood, it is my pleasure to appear in a story entitled The Dark, Dark Hours," Reagan intones. Young James Dean, one of the bright new actors in Hollywood, appears with me, and Constance Ford plays my wife on the General Electric Theater. The GE theme music comes up as the camera pulls back. Reagan's introduction completed, the scene changes as the camera lens again zeroes in. Now viewers can see that Reagan is in costume. He's wearing pajamas and a bathrobe. In his role as the kindly Dr. Joe, Ronald Reagan answers the door in the middle of the night to find a thuggish James Dean playing a character named Bud, imploring Dr. Joe to help a friend who has mysteriously suffered a gunshot wound. Reagan's skepticism about television is clearly gone. His job as host of GE Theater gives him the opportunity to be seen in millions of homes each week, talking about the evening's program and sometimes acting in the dramatic presentation. He is lucky to be in the forefront of top motion picture actors who are now crossing over to television. James Dean, or Jimmy, as Reagan refers to him, is making his second appearance on GE Theater just weeks after starring with former child actress Natalie Wood in an adaptation of Sherwood Anderson's short story, I'm a Fool. Neither Dean nor Wood knows they will soon play opposite one another in the landmark motion picture, Rebel Without a Cause. On this night, Reagan plays the hero to Dean's villain, the sort of dashing role that has eluded him for years in motion pictures. By the end of the brief teleplay, Reagan's character has not only wrestled a .32-caliber pistol away from the suicidal Bud, but has shown a flash of anger and a knowledge of weaponry that hints at a much darker past. Reagan more than holds his own with Dean, a young actor being hailed as one of the best in Hollywood. The scene concludes with the scowling Reagan shoving a sobbing James Dean, then hugging his family. Reagan's mastery as a thespian is complete. The viewer is lost in the rage exhibited by his character. The screen goes black. The credits roll. Then, suddenly, the action shifts to a now smiling and chipper Ronald Reagan sitting in his dressing room as he once again speaks into the camera. He is still wearing the pajamas and bathrobe, but gone is the brooding and angst so evident just a few seconds ago. Magically, he has returned to a confident, likable persona. "Well," he tells the audience, still winded from his physical interchange with Dean, "I hope you've enjoyed James Dean, Constance Ford, and the rest of us." In fact, America enjoys GE Theater very much, and Ronald Reagan in particular. The show is a smash hit. Reagan's career is back on solid footing, as is his bank account. But there is more to being the MC of GE Theater than just introducing the night's show and an occasional spot of acting. General Electric is a giant corporation with plants located in 31 states. As part of his contract, Reagan is required to travel to these factories as a goodwill ambassador. It is the thinking of GE's corporate leadership in New York that having the host of their signature television show intermingle with the workers will be good for morale. Afraid of flying, Reagan travels the country by train and takes time to speak with and listen to each employee he meets. At first, all I did was walk the assembly lines at GE plants, or if it didn't interrupt production, I'd speak to them in small groups from a platform set up on the floor of the factories, he will later write. Reagan is surprised to discover that this clause in his contract is just as fulfilling as his time before the camera. For with every factory he visits, he learns more about the economy and local governments, often accepting invitations to speak to civic groups. The political passion that has lain dormant since his stepping down as president of the Screen Actors Guild 3 years ago is now being rekindled. Reagan has come to believe that less governmental interference is the best path for America. The long train rides give him plenty of time to ruminate on this and to write careful speeches on stacks of 3x5 cards. He wraps a rubber band around each stack and saves them. Someday his words will be melded into a spectacular thesis that will become known as the speech. It is the speech that will not only change the course of Ronald Reagan's life, but also make him a marked man. On November 18, 1956, a somber Ronald Reagan opens the latest installment of GE Theater wearing a coat and tie. James Dean is dead, killed in a car accident 1 year ago. Due to popular public demand, GE Theater is rebroadcasting the production of I'm a Fool, starring Dean and his Rebel Without a Cause co-star Natalie Wood. Reagan speaks fondly of Dean, but never flashes a smile or a hint of the trademark warmth that has become synonymous with the host of GE Theater. Jimmy Dean, he tells his television audience, was a young actor with unlimited potential. Reagan's monologue on Dean signals that his years as a lightweight Hollywood actor are coming to an end. He has begun an inexorable journey into ideological warfare and public service that no one, not even Ronald Reagan, could ever have seen coming. Thus, Reagan's words about James Dean's unlimited potential can also be used to describe him. 6. Ardmore, Oklahoma, May 29, 1955, 6 a.m. As a 28-year-old mother of two is about to give birth to her third child, she and her husband are hoping that it will be a boy. They are affluent people with a strong belief in the American dream. If their child is indeed a boy, it will be named after his father, who, in addition to being president of Ardmore's Optimist Club, is a deeply religious and highly prosperous oil man. There will one day be whispers that he is connected to the Central Intelligence Agency, whispers that will be scrutinized very closely. But all this is in the future as the hoped-for baby boy enters the world. 2 miles across the Oklahoma town, a brand new and modern memorial hospital is opening to the public. The newborn baby boy could very well have earned the honor of being the first child delivered in this state-of-the-art facility. That would be a mark of distinction, if only in Ardmore. But Joanne, as the mother is named, has opted to deliver at a hospital known as the Hardy Sanitarium, which will make the birth unique in another way. The opening of the new hospital will mean that Hardy, a two-story brick building that has been a vital part of Ardmore's fabric for 44 years, will now close for good on this very day. Rather than being the first baby born in the new hospital, Joanne's baby will be the last born at Hardy. So it is that John Warnock Hinckley, Jr. is born in an obsolete mental hospital. At first glance, the baby appears to be completely normal. 7. Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, July 15, 1960, 8 p.m. The man with 3 years to live is nervous. Senator John F. Kennedy steps to the podium and gazes out at 80,000 Democrats who are on their feet cheering loudly. The 43-year-old patrician from Massachusetts is perspiring lightly. His eyes scan the vast outdoor Los Angeles Coliseum with its vaulting peristyle arches and Olympic cauldron signifying the Olympic Games held there in 1932. This is a spot reserved for conquering heroes, the same lofty perch where General George S. Patton was welcomed on leave from World War II in 1945. Just 2 days ago, the wealthy politician with movie star good looks received the necessary votes to secure the Democratic nomination for president. Now, as the National Convention comes to a close with his acceptance speech, bedlam fills the Coliseum. Native Americans in full tribal regalia perform ritual dances on the football field, and low-flying TV news helicopters threaten to drown out Kennedy's words. With many high-ranking Democrats looking on in person and famous Kennedy celebrity backers such as Henry Fonda and Frank Sinatra joining the festivities, John F. Kennedy begins his speech. "With a deep sense of duty and high resolve, I accept your nomination." Kennedy's words are clipped, and he speaks too fast. He has slept very little in the past week, filling his days and nights with political meetings, parties, and rendezvous with would-be girlfriends. Among them are Judith Campbell and the actress Marilyn Monroe. Campbell, who once dated Frank Sinatra, will go on to become the mistress of mobster Sam Giancana. "I accept it with a full and grateful heart, without reservation, and with only one obligation, the obligation to devote every effort of body, mind, and spirit to lead our party back to victory and our nation back to greatness." Kennedy now launches into what will become known as the New Frontier speech, telling Americans, "Today our concern must be with that future, for the world is changing. The old era is ending. The old ways will not do." As he outlines his vision for the future, Kennedy launches a series of personal attacks on his likely Republican opponent, current Vice President of the United States, Richard Milhouse Nixon. A continent away, Nixon himself cannot sleep. The CBS television network is broadcasting Kennedy's speech live. Despite its being 11 p.m. in Washington, Nixon is riveted to the black-and-white TV in the family room of his Tudor-style home in the city's Wesley Heights neighborhood. He endures every one of his opponent's assaults, taking each slight personally, but also knowing that Kennedy does this all the time, as he is fond of hardball politics. "Mr. Nixon may feel it is his turn now," Kennedy says somewhat sarcastically. Nixon, an acute observer, notes Kennedy's lean face is tense, despite the senator's attempts to appear at ease. "After the New Deal and the Fair Deal, but before he deals, someone had better cut the cards." The audience laughs. Kennedy continues, "That someone may be the millions of Americans who voted for President Eisenhower, but balk at his would-be self-appointed successor. For just as historians tell us that Richard I was not fit to fill the shoes of bold Henry II, and that Richard Cromwell was not fit to wear the mantle of his uncle, they might add in future years that Richard Nixon did not measure to the footsteps of Dwight D. Eisenhower." Nixon is 47 years old, but his thick jowls and receding hairline make him look 10 years older. He is a man of humble beginnings, unlike Kennedy, who was born into great wealth. In truth, JFK is closer to the commonly held image of a Republican. Fraternity presidents, tax board assessors, community leaders, surgeons, Pullman porters, head nurses, and the fat sons of rich fathers— as one writer described the party faithful. The writer was Norman Mailer in a piece for Esquire about the 1960 Democratic National Convention titled "Superman Comes to the Supermarket." Nixon put himself through law school, served in the Navy during World War II, then successfully ran for Congress in 1946. He believes strongly in the Republican virtues of fiscal conservatism, small government, and a powerful military. Nixon has a keen political mind. He has watched Kennedy's rise to power closely, recognizing for almost a year that JFK will be his likely opponent for the presidency. Now, mentally cataloging each item in Kennedy's new frontier agenda, knowing he must co-opt some of these themes and give them a Republican spin, Nixon concentrates heavily upon his rival. Nixon's wife, Pat, and two young daughters, Tricia and Julie, are fast asleep, but he has no immediate plans to join them. He listens closely as Kennedy concludes his speech to thunderous applause. "As we face the coming challenge, we too shall wait upon the Lord and ask that he renew our strength. Then shall we be equal to the test. Then we shall not be weary. And then we shall prevail." Nixon is not impressed. Those 80,000 Democrats might seem like a lot, but he well knows the Coliseum can hold many thousands more. Nixon also considers himself a better politician than his rival and believes he can win the election if he can convince some Democrats to swing away from their party. Nixon needs crossover votes. "In this campaign, I make a prediction," he will tell the audience when he accepts the Republican nomination for the presidency 13 days from now. "I say that just as in 1952 and 1956, millions of Democrats will join us, not because they are deserting their party, but because their party deserted them at Los Angeles 2 weeks ago." Another man is also intensely watching John F. Kennedy. Sitting in the living room of his lavish Pacific Palisades home, Ronald Reagan is disgusted by what he is hearing. At the conclusion of Kennedy's speech, Reagan gets up and wanders to the floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking the spectacular view of the distant lights of Los Angeles. Reagan's mind is made up. He will cast his vote for Richard Nixon. This will come as no surprise to anyone in Hollywood. While still technically a Democrat, Reagan has been heavily influenced by the more conservative views espoused by his wife Nancy, who grew up in an extremely Republican household and likes to brag that she has been reading the right-leaning National Review since its first issue. The motion picture industry is deeply divided between liberals and conservatives. A minority of actors, such as Reagan and John Wayne, openly espouse anti-communist small government views— but a much larger contingent, led by singer Frank Sinatra and his Rat Pack, have fallen under John F. Kennedy's spell. This group includes actors Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, Elizabeth Taylor, Cary Grant, and Angie Dickinson. While some keep a distance between their personal and professional lives, Sinatra in particular has made it clear that he despises not only Ronald Reagan's views, but also Reagan himself. "Dumb and dangerous," Sinatra calls Reagan, "and so simple-minded." The singer takes his vitriol a step further by also attacking Nancy Reagan, calling her a dope with fat ankles who could never make it as an actress. Despite his career resurgence on television and the wealth that has allowed him to build this spectacular four-bedroom, 4,700-square-foot home at the end of a long private road in the Pacific Palisades, Ronald Reagan and his wife have become social pariahs. They are rarely invited to the best parties, and even when a dinner offer comes their way, Reagan has a bad habit of lecturing all within earshot about politics. Nancy, for her part, does not help matters by appearing condescending. "We got stuck with them at a dinner party, and it was awful," the wife of screenwriter Philip Dunn once remembered. "Nancy is so assessing. She always looks you up and down before she deigns to speak." Turning away from the window, Reagan walks past the large stone fireplace and into his small corner office. He sits down and takes pen and paper from a drawer. General Electric has taken great pride in turning his home into the House of the Future, and has capitalized on that concept by having Reagan film commercials for the General Electric Theater from his own kitchen, surrounded by a GE toaster, dishwasher, and electric garbage disposal. But no modern gadget will help Reagan perform the simple task of writing a letter. Ronald Reagan is not afraid to mail his thoughts to anyone who will read them, as well as many who don't want to. Letter writing from his home office has become the nexus for Reagan's personal conservative movement, and with each letter he sends, his political ambition advances. With Kennedy's words still echoing in his mind, Reagan picks up his pen and begins writing a letter to Richard Nixon. "Dear Mr. Vice President," the letter begins, "I know this is presumptuous of me, but I'm passing on some thoughts after viewing the convention here in L.A. I heard a frightening call to arms. Unfortunately, he is a powerful speaker with an appeal to the emotions. He leaves little doubt that his idea of the challenging new world is one in which the federal government will grow bigger and do more, and, of course, spend more." Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon first became acquainted back in 1947 when Reagan appeared before Congress. They rekindled that relationship in 1950 when Reagan campaigned for Nixon's opponent in the race for a U.S. Senate seat from California. They've since become friends, and Nixon is actually the reason Reagan still maintains his Democratic Party membership. When Reagan told Nixon he was planning to switch parties in time for the 1960 election, the canny Nixon said he could do more for the Republican Party by remaining a Democrat and using his fame to convince other Democrats to cross party lines with him. So Reagan remains a Democrat, at least for now. He has no idea that Nixon actually considers him shallow and of limited mental capacity. But even if he did know that, it might not matter. Ronald Reagan simply wants to see John F. Kennedy and his liberal dogma defeated. Reagan continues his letter. "I know there must be some short-sighted people within the Republican Party who will advise that the Republicans should try to out-liberal him. In my opinion, this would be fatal. I don't pose as an infallible pundit, but I have a strong feeling that the 20 million non-voters in this country just might be conservatives." But Nixon is not planning to take Reagan's advice. In 1 week's time, he will fly to New York and meet with Republican Governor Nelson Rockefeller. After a dinner of lamb chops in Rocky's Fifth Avenue apartment, the two men will stay up all night drafting a more liberal Republican platform. The Treaty of Fifth Avenue, as it will be dubbed, is designed to appeal to independent and Democratic voters. Reagan concludes the letter, scalding John F. Kennedy. "Under the tousled boyish haircut is still old Karl Marx, first launched a century ago. There is nothing new in the idea of a government being big brother to us all. Hitler called his State Socialism. Reagan's animosity toward John F. Kennedy will continue even after the young president is shot dead by an assassin's bullet. On November 22, 1963, just a few hours after JFK is assassinated, Ronald and Nancy Reagan will hold a dinner. "Why should we cancel our dinner party just because John F. Kennedy died? Don't be silly," Nancy Reagan told one guest who called to ask if the party was still on. The man, a film producer and former U.S. Army Brigadier General named Frank McCarthy, arrived to find Ronald Reagan, John Wayne, and actor Robert Taylor socializing. As a film producer, McCarthy will go on to win the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1970 for Patton. Signing the letter Ronnie Reagan, the actor fervently hopes his offer to campaign for Richard Nixon will be accepted. Though Nixon will lose the 1960 presidential election by less than 1 percentage point of all votes polled, Reagan will speak on his behalf whenever asked. "Have you registered as a Republican yet?" shouts a voice from the audience. The year is 1962. As Ronald Reagan predicted, Richard Nixon's attempt to out-liberal John Kennedy is among the factors that cost him the presidency. Now Reagan is once again campaigning for Nixon, this time as the former vice president runs for governor of California. Reagan stands before a small crowd of Republican supporters. The fundraising event is being held in a house just down the street from his Pacific Palisades home. Reagan knows many of those in attendance, but does not recognize this voice speaking to him in the middle of the living room. "Have you registered as a Republican yet?" she asks a second time. "Well, no, I haven't yet, but I intend to." The truth is, Ronald Reagan no longer has any reason to remain a Democrat. His conservative affiliations have become so notorious that General Electric recently fired him as a spokesman under pressure from some powerful liberal concerns. So, once again, Ronald Reagan is an unemployed actor searching for his next paycheck. He has absolutely, positively nothing to lose by switching political parties. "I'm a registrar," the woman says, standing up and walking toward Reagan with a slip of paper in her hand. She hands the paper to Reagan. It is a registration form. The woman has already filled in all the blanks, meaning that with a simple swipe of his pen, Ronald Reagan will officially become a Republican. The registrar hands Reagan a pen. He signs the form without a moment's hesitation. As the room erupts in applause, Reagan smiles. There will come a time when few will even remember his 30 years as a Democrat. "I did not leave the Democratic Party," he will tell people, borrowing a line from Richard Nixon. "The Democratic Party left me." Now, in the first moments of his new life as a Republican, Ronald Reagan gets back to the task at hand. "Now where was I?" he asks, before continuing the speech he has been perfecting for the last 8 years. A bitter Richard Nixon strides purposefully onto the stage at the Beverly Hilton Hotel in Los Angeles. The date is November 7, 1962. Despite Ronald Reagan's campaign efforts, Nixon has just lost the election for governor of California, an election he assumed he would win easily. The governorship was meant to be a job that would keep Nixon in the public eye until 1968. He believed that John F. Kennedy would be president for 2 terms, so he would wait until then to tender another presidential bid. Now, an exhausted and angry Richard Nixon faces the harsh reality that he is finished. It will be a political near impossibility to recover from this loss. But before he goes, Nixon has a few words he would like to say. His face is lined with tension. Nixon forces a smile as he looks at the reporters assembled before him. There is no podium, just a cluster of microphones. He is nervous about the speech he is about to give, but is attempting to appear jovial. The 49-year-old Nixon considers the media to be his personal enemy and believes that after years of frustrated silence, the time has come to tell them off. Nixon digs his right hand deep into the pocket of his suit pants. An elaborate chandelier hovers to one side of the room. Reporters sit at a long table in front of him, poised with pencil and paper to write down his words. To his right, Television cameras and newspaper photographers prepare to capture this moment of defeat.
"For 16 years," Nixon begins, "you've had an opportunity to attack me, and I think I've given as good as I've taken."
A hush fills the small ballroom. Nixon has just crossed a line. It is one thing to confront a journalist about his coverage in private, but to do so in public is taboo, and thanks to all those television cameras, this verbal assault is now being filmed for posterity. Pencils scribble frantically as the reporters eagerly await Nixon's next words.
"I will leave you, gentlemen, now, and, you will now write it. You will interpret it. That's your right. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore, because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference."
59 seconds. That's all it takes. Nixon does not field questions. He is whisked from the room and walks quickly out of the hotel, stopping only to shake the hand of a front desk clerk before stepping into the front seat of a waiting car. He is thrilled to have gotten the last word. Yet fate will allow him many more press conferences. And if Richard Nixon thinks the media have gotten the best of him in the past, that is nothing compared to what they will do to him in the future.
2 years later, television cameras again capture a historic moment. The night is October 27, 1964. Ronald Reagan is eagerly anticipating watching himself on television. The occasion is a speech he taped 1 week earlier in support of Republican presidential nominee Barry Goldwater. One young supporter of Goldwater and an active member of the Young Republican movement was a 17-year-old Chicago-area young lady named Hillary Rodham. She was fond of wearing a cowgirl outfit and a straw hat emblazoned with the Goldwater campaign's AUH2O slogan. AU is the periodic symbol for gold, H2O the symbol for water. Shortly afterwards, she would switch her party allegiance to the Democrats, perhaps under pressure from her liberal friends at Wellesley College. At first, Goldwater's people wanted Reagan to deliver the speech live. But Reagan is by now a canny politician, and although he would have liked the spontaneous applause and laughter that he knew each line would engender, he didn't want to take any chances on making a mistake. Thus, the live scenario was scrapped. "Nancy and I went to the home of some friends to watch the broadcast," he will later write of the night that changed his life. Reagan's presentation for Goldwater was so successful that scribes simply dubbed Reagan's words "the speech." Reagan realizes his career is now in public life. After a 7-year break between films, he has made one last motion picture. He played a villain in The Killers, a movie that sank without a trace at the box office. Even though the speech is a sensation, Barry Goldwater's advisors did not want Reagan's talk to air. With the election just 1 week away, they were terrified that the conservative themes he was espousing would drive some voters into the Democratic camp. As the Reagans sit side by side before the television set in the den of their friend's home, the black-and-white screen flickers, showing him standing behind a podium draped with patriotic bunting. The edited presentation then cuts to the back of the room, allowing the nation to see the audience awaiting his words. Some hold placards. Others wear cowboy hats. All are dressed informally and are meant to look like a homey cross-section of the American public. This works perfectly with Reagan's homespun delivery, the gentle parental voice that he perfected at those GE factories, after dinner speeches, and countless other conservative venues across the country. Unlike most television programs, the performer hasn't been provided with a script, he assures the audience as he begins. "As a matter of fact, I have been permitted to choose my own words and discuss my own ideas regarding the choice that we face in the next few weeks." Then, Reagan begins a 27-minute soliloquy on the virtues of the America in which he truly believes. The Republican presidential nominee, Barry Goldwater, is hardly mentioned. Reagan delivers a dazzling speech full of allusions to the American dream, fiscal conservatism, and small government.
He speaks of freedom and the founding fathers as if they were brand new concepts that Americans need to embrace immediately. He talks about poverty, farmers, the Vietnam War, Cuban immigrants, and American veterans. There is no hesitation in Reagan's voice, no fumbling with the words of his self-written script, for this is the summation of what he has believed for years. "You and I have a rendezvous with destiny," he concludes, his voice at its most earnest and inspirational. "We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness." Ronald and Nancy Reagan drive home in their Lincoln Continental after watching the filmed speech. The 53-year-old Reagan is nervous, unsure if his talk has been a success. Others who watched the speech with them insist that Reagan did his job well, but he is still uncertain. The October night is partly cloudy, with temperatures in the low 70s. The Reagans park their car, then walk inside the house and go to bed, still not knowing if the speech has been a success or a flop. It is midnight when the bedside phone rings. The Goldwater campaign is on the other end. Reagan's speech has been such a smash that people from all across the country have called in, pledging support and money for the candidate. A Time for Choosing, as the speech will come to be known, will be described by reporters as the most successful national political debut since William Jennings Bryan electrified the 1896 Democratic Convention with the Cross of Gold speech. "That speech was one of the most important milestones of my life," Reagan will later remember. Until that day, he had been skeptical of any suggestion that he run for political office. Now, that is about to change. A Time for Choosing will turn out to be, in his words, "another one of those unexpected turns that led me onto a path I never expected to take."